Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief of Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a senior writer at Live Science. The world can be a pretty mysterious place, and we at Live Science love to ask and answer questions about mysteries big and small, about ancient civilizations, our planet and solar system, the plants and animals that live alongside us, our bodies and how they work, and technologies that we use every day.
Each episode of this podcast introduces three mysterious questions, and we think the answers will really surprise you.
We'll also hear from scientists who are performing cutting-edge research in labs and in fieldwork around the world to answer these and other intriguing scientific questions.
In today's episode of Life's Little Mysteries, we'll take a closer look at a mysterious object in space that's our closest cosmic neighbor, the moon. So what makes the moon so special?
Well, it's, you know, it's the brightest, largest object in the sky that we can look at directly. So, you know, so the moon is, it's inspired the human imagination for thousands of years, even, you know, long before people even knew what it was. So, and, you know, it's like, well, compare it to the sun, right? I mean, you know, the sun rises and sets and, you know, you get pretty sunsets and, you know, pretty sunrises where the colors change, but the sun itself looks pretty much the same from day to day.
And the moon changes, obviously. We can look up into the sky and see sometimes it's a crescent or we get the full moons.
Right, right. So you know, so just because there's that variation, that's one of the things that I think has just fascinated people for so long. And it's, you know, it's shaped religions and ancient civilizations. It's inspired myths about gods and goddesses. And, you know, it has the power to create monsters like werewolves. And you can still see, you know, that it inspires poets and musicians and artists today.
I mean, the list of moon songs.
Oh, my God. There are so many moon songs. Yeah. Blue Moon and Moon River and Man on the Moon and, yeah.
Dark Side of the Moon.
Dark Side. Too many to list. So what is the moon?
So the moon is our lone satellite. Well, actually, scientists are learning that we might have a mini moon.
Mini moons. I know. Mini moons. Moons.
It's the satellite we know and love. And it could be a chunk of us. It could be a chunk of Earth.
Right.
Orbiting us.
Right. And so it could have been like broken off of Earth about 4.5 billion years ago from an impact with like a Mars sized asteroid. So something slammed into Earth, broke off a piece of it, but it never went away. It just stayed close by orbiting and that became our moon.
And the reason it shines is because it reflects light from the sun.
Right. So the phases when we say like, you know, you can just see like one, like a, you know, a little bit of brightness or a lot of brightness, what those are is that's based on where the moon is in its orbit relative to the positions of the Earth and the sun.
And unlike Earth, it doesn't have a core and it doesn't have all the activity, all the active processes like we have with volcanoes and things.
Right. It has no atmosphere. It's just like a dead hunk of rock, but it actually does have moonquakes. So even though it doesn't have like, you know, earthquakes, you know, are caused by the shifting of tectonic plates and the movement of magma, but on the moon, there actually is like, you know, is some shrinkage in the surface crust. And what that does is that builds up energy and faults and then it releases as moonquakes. But let's look at where the moon is. How far away is the moon?
So the moon's about 239,000 miles from us, which is it's more than 380,000 kilometers.
Okay. And this, you know, even though it's just, you know, this like small chunk of Earth, it's, you know, it's still a reasonable size.
Right. It's over 6,700 miles across its equator, right, which is almost 11,000 kilometers.
Right. And I think NASA put that in a really good way. So they said that if Earth were the size of a nickel, the moon would be about as big as a coffee bean.
Which makes it pretty small.
Yeah, compared to Earth.
It's a little piece of Earth.
Yeah.
And it takes about 27 Earth days for the moon to make its way around us.
Right. And it gets much colder there than it does on Earth. The coldest temperatures that we know of on the moon are -387 degrees Fahrenheit, which is -233 degrees Celsius. And at its hottest, it's 253 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 123 degrees Celsius. So much more extreme temperatures.
Yeah. And we don't just see the moon. We can actually feel the effects of the moon. And
right,
we see that in tides every day. The gravity from the moon actually is pulling on our oceans. And, you know, surfers do watch the tides to know and where the moon is, because there are stronger tides when the moon is closer.
Right. So when the moon is close, it's like the gravitational pull of the moon is what pulls the tides. And then as it moves away, that's what, then the tides can move out again.
And we've also been to the moon. It's the one space object we've actually touched down on.
Right. People have walked on it. Yeah. So the very first visit was NASA's Apollo 11 mission. That was the first to land humans on the moon. And that was under Commander Neil Armstrong and lunar module pilot Buzz Aldrin. And that was on July 20th, 1969. Michael Collins was the third astronaut on that mission. He stayed in the command module for 28 hours.
I can't even imagine that, though, thinking about your colleagues are on the surface of the moon. I mean, it's an important job. It was communicating, taking photos.
Right. Even though he did not actually get to walk on the moon. He said in interviews, and I think this is great, he said that he actually, you know, didn't mind that he was the only one up there because he appreciated the quiet.
I'm sure it was very quiet.
It was very peaceful. Yeah. So, and 50 years after that, 12 people in total have walked on the moon. The last one to do it was Eugene Cernan, and that was in 1972. And then on top of the 12 people that have actually, you know, set foot on the moon, 12 more people have flown within 0.001 lunar distance of its surface. So they have been on missions that have gone to the moon, but they haven't actually gone down to the surface.
There are plans. There are more plans to visit the moon. What's up next?
Well, in 2018 and 2019, China, India, and Israel all sent landers to the moon, but not all of those missions were successful. Of all of those, only China was able to successfully put a lander on the lunar surface. We're going to talk about that a little bit later.
And the United States just established a space force, and that was last December, right. 2019. Will it go to the moon?
It's unclear. We're not sure exactly what's on the table for what the space force is going to do first. But there has been talk in press conferences of establishing moon bases. So today we're going to talk about some of the big questions that are part of humanity's modern relationship with the moon since we started sending landers, orbiters, and people to study it up close.
We'll look at the challenges of visiting the moon, what it might be like to live there, and how our visits are changing the lunar surface, and not for the better.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem. We've had a main beam bus thunderbolt.
Roger, main beam interval. Okay, stand by at 13. We're looking at it.
That famous audio clip is from the NASA Apollo 13 mission. It was spoken on April 13, 1970 by astronaut Jim Lovell, and he had called mission control after one of the oxygen tanks blew up and a second one failed. So the astronauts and NASA had to improvise to build a carbon dioxide filter, and then the astronauts had to navigate home with very little electrical power. So they did return safely on April 18th, but it was really, really tense. And you know, people around the country were following this as this was unfolding, and it really demonstrated the dangers of space travel.
In spite of the risks and dangers, space agencies have been sending missions to the moon since the 1960s, as we talked about. The first to go there were the Soviets and then NASA, which were the first to actually bring people to the lunar surface.
Right. So there were 6 NASA missions that landed crews. A lot more missions landed probes or crashed them, in some cases intentionally, though. And, you know, you'd think the moon is so close. After the first few successful missions, you're like, you know, we've done this before. But of course, the recent missions by Israel and India were unsuccessful, and their landers, which crashed during entry, kind of serves as a reminder of just, you know, how difficult this is to do.
If you look back over all the missions, about 1/3 of them have actually ended in failure.
Right. So let's launch into our first mystery. Why is it so hard to land on the moon?
And we've had some recent examples of the difficulty in landing.
Right. We've seen that firsthand, and especially because this happened in 2019, you know, now we're at the point where we really can, because of video and social media, we can actually see what's happening in mission control as these missions are going to the moon in real time. And yes, in 2019, so there were these just heartbreaking crashes after years of research and effort from dozens of scientists. So there was, first there was the Israeli Bereshit spacecraft, which was sent to the moon on February 21st in 2019. It flew on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. It made orbit on April 4th and was scheduled to land autonomously, but then mission control lost communication with the spacecraft when it was just a little more than 500 feet from the surface, and then it crashed on April 11th in 2019.
So we also saw this in the summer of 2019 with India.
Right. This was India's second moon mission. It was Chandrayaan-2, and that was a combination of a lander, a rover, and an orbiter. So Chandrayaan-2 launched to the moon on July 22nd, 2019, and orbit insertion was on August 20th. And then the Vikram lander and the Pragyan rover were scheduled to land on the moon in the southern polar region on September 6th. So the three vehicles were initially launched as one combined spacecraft to, achieve orbit. And then the lander carrying the rover was going to go down to the surface, but that did not happen as planned. And so it just they lost contact with it, and it was presumed to have crashed. And then when NASA's active orbiter, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, passed over the site of the suspected crash, it spotted the wreckage on November 11th.
And we remember this in the newsroom because our sister site, space.com, was covering it, and they didn't know what had happened. Was it successful and it just lost communication, or
Or did it actually crash?
Yeah.
Right. And then when the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter actually captured images, then they could see from the surface they could see the wreckage. They could see, where it had gone down.
The ejecta that basically came up from where it impacted the surface.
Right. So the orbiter, the orbiter from the Indian Space Agency is still there. So Chandrayaan-2 is still it's still orbiting the moon, but of course the lander and the rover just did not survive the journey.
And it's not so much that one thing goes wrong and just, derails everything. It's just that so many things with these missions have to go exactly right.
Right. And of course, the first big challenge is getting to the moon at all.
Right. And you can see the different times that it takes to get to the moon. You know, it's pretty close. I think a straight shot could be over 3 days or something. But here it's taking months to get there.
Right. So obviously the fuel quantity and type, it determines how quickly a rocket can get to the moon. So NASA's for example, NASA's Saturn V rocket, which is what propelled the Apollo program. It carried the missions there in just a matter of days. But by comparison, the Indian Space Agency's Chandrayaan-2 mission, it took months to reach the moon. That launched in July 22nd and arrived on August 20th.
So they were saving on fuel costs,
right.
I'm assuming. Yes, okay.
Right. But of course, that with a longer trip, that of course raises the risk that something can go wrong. And so it's hard to tell exactly, where the things started to happen that, ultimately culminated
in the
failure, right? Yeah. But obviously having a longer trip to the moon, that just, raises the chance that something could go wrong.
So in addition to reaching the moon, we need to be able to communicate. The scientists need to be able to communicate with the spacecraft and with the rovers and things that are getting to the moon.
Right. So in fact, for the Indian Space Agency, a communications failure may have been partly responsible for the troubles with the Vikram lunar lander. So the space agency, ISRO, they lost contact when Vikram was just about 1.2 miles or 2 kilometers above the lunar surface. So And then for the Israeli lander, which crashed on April 11th, there was a faulty data transmission instrument, and that led to a total engine shutdown. So when it comes to guiding autonomous vehicles, here on Earth, obviously we can use GPS because we have these networks of satellites that can send information that can tell these robotic vehicles or these self-driving vehicles where to go. We don't have that on the moon, so we don't have that on any other. Bodies outside of Earth. So that is something that, that raises, special challenges for trying to send these missions to the moon, where they then have to perform these functions pretty much on their own once they get there, because we don't have this backup system that engineers and designers rely on here on Earth.
And an interesting thing when you look back at these missions that have failed, one of the things they have in common is that there were no people on board, which is great because no one got hurt. But
So there was no loss of life, but it's also interesting because I think sometimes there is an assumption with especially when you're looking at rocket science and space travel, that that technology that takes people out of the equation is actually going to be more reliable or will be easier to control. But actually what we saw during the Apollo missions is that having human eyes and reflexes actually helped to make these landings successful. And in fact, the Apollo 11 descent was very famously rerouted, sort of pretty much on the fly, as it were, right, by Neil Armstrong, because the original landing site, as they were coming in, he noticed that it looked very rocky. And so that could have potentially created problems for the lander. So what he did was he took control of the descent vehicle and was able to touch down at a safer location. So having people can actually, you know, give you just another layer of decision making that that, you know, autonomous technology may not be able to, you know, reliably make. And so that could be a factor in, you know, why there was, you know, why there were these mission failures in these missions that didn't have people there.
Yeah. And they're well trained. Neil Armstrong had done tons of simulations on Earth. He knew exactly what he was doing. I mean, it's incredible that he did this within minutes.
Right.
And figured out how to land safely.
Right, right. So you know, as much as autonomous vehicles and robotics have transformed spacecraft and space exploration, there is still definitely something to be said for human reflexes and human judgment.
So we love talking about the moon here on Life's Little Mysteries, but do you know what else is out of this world? The Great Courses Plus. What is it? It's streaming lectures on an incredible diversity of topics, from astrophysics to archaeology to cooking, you name it, mysteries of the human brain, just about any topic. It gives unlimited access to thousands of these lectures. So you can indulge your curiosity in art history, how to take better photos, improve at yoga, appreciate fine wines, and plenty of science mysteries. The internet provides a lot of information, but sometimes the sources can be pretty sketchy. And that's one reason we love the Great Courses Plus, because each of the lectures is hosted by university professors and respected educators and experts. So you know what you're getting is information that you can trust. And one of the features that makes this so great is that the Great Courses Plus has an app. So you can watch and listen. You can toggle between the video and the audio. If you want to stop at one point and start, you can continue where you left off. You can switch between courses and you can download.
One course that we really recommend checking out is the Science of Extreme Weather. So, you know, of course, we've been talking about the moon, and there's no weather on the moon, but Earth is a dynamic planet, and there are plenty of interactions between land and atmosphere and the ocean that shape all kinds of extreme weather, from blizzards to monsoons to tornadoes. And what this course will do is it'll introduce you to some of the aspects of not just how these types of extreme weather happen, but how scientists are studying them, how they're learning to better understand them, and even how they're learning to predict them.
So don't wait for a rainy day. Sign up now for the Great Courses Plus. And for a limited time only, they are offering our listeners an entire month for free. But to start your free month trial, you must sign up today using our special URL.
Sign up now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/LLM. And that's LLM for Life's Little Mysteries. Remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/LLM.
When NASA does start sending astronauts for short visits on the moon, they're targeting the region around the South Pole where spots inside craters provide the perfect conditions for water ice. And recent research into that ice found some interesting results. Joining us today to talk about that research is Ariel Deutsch, a doctoral candidate at Brown University in Rhode Island and a NASA graduate fellow. Hi, Ariel. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
Can you give us a sense of your research field? It sounds like it's a combination of a couple of different research topics, right?
For my research, I focus a lot on Mercury and the moon, in trying to understand the nature of water cycles on these two bodies.
What led you to study ice craters on the moon?
So one of the major outstanding questions still about ice on the moon is trying to understand where it came from. And one tool for understanding where it came from is thinking about when it was delivered to the moon. This is because the ice can be delivered from different delivery mechanisms, and these delivery mechanisms have operated at different times throughout lunar history.
There's so many craters all over the moon. Is there ice in all of them? Where have we found ice?
So ice obviously requires very cold temperatures in order for it to survive on the surface of the moon. And so where we find ice at the surface is only within craters at the poles that are in these regions we call permanently shadowed. And so these areas actually don't receive any direct sunlight. And so their temperatures are below freezing, which is cold enough for water ice to sustain at the surface.
How did you figure out how old that ice is? Do we actually have samples of it?
No, so we don't. We weren't exactly finding the precise age of the ice. What we're using is something that's called relative dating. And so it's this principle where if ice exists at the surface of a crater, then it must be younger than the age of the crater that hosts it. And so we're dating the craters themselves, not the ice within the craters. And the way that we can date craters is by actually looking at the density of craters on top of that crater. And so it's this principle where if you put out a piece of paper when it starts to rain, for example, at the beginning of the rainstorm, there will only be a few raindrops on the piece of paper. But of course, the longer that you leave it out in the rainstorm, the more raindrops will accumulate on that piece of paper. And so the same principle is used to date planetary surfaces, where the longer a surface is exposed to the space weathering environment, the more impact it will be exposed to, and they will have a higher density of craters. And so essentially we're creating this probability distribution of its age by looking at the density of craters on top of it.
How interesting. And so you looked at these craters in images?
Yep, through a variety of images. But also, since we're working at the poles where the ice exists, we're in a lot of regions where it's permanently shadowed. And so we don't have clear images within these shadows. But we do have very high resolution topographic measurements of the surface, which essentially measure the shape of the surface. And so by creating digital terrain models of the surface, we're able to reconstruct what the surface looks like even within shadow. And this is what we're using from the instrument called LOLA, which is the Lunar Orbiter Laser Altimeter, which is currently on LRO, which orbits the moon even today.
And that's the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, yes?
Yeah, and then all of these density measurements are actually tied to absolute ages from our Apollo samples.
And you use these density findings to measure the ages?
Yeah, so for the different craters that we were interested, we looked at the crater densities, and then these are tied to what's called a chronology or production function, which basically is a statistical description of a surface based on predicted impact flux into the moon over time. And so this varies as a function of time. There were a lot more impacts early on in the moon's history than there are today, for example. But by tying these different crater densities to rocks on the moon that have been measured in the lab from the Apollo samples, we're able to connect all of these different pieces of information to help date the surface.
What did you find?
With this particular study, we found that where the ice exists is predominantly in very old craters. So craters that are over 3 billion years old in age. And again, as I was saying, this provides an upper limit to the age of the ice. So even though where it exists is very old, the age of the ice itself could be anywhere younger than that. We also found that the ice itself is in a very patchy distribution in the shadows. And this has been observed with a variety of different data sets through time. And so this has been used to suggest that perhaps the ice itself is very old, because over time you would expect the ice to be sort of broken up and beaten up through time.
And you also found there are some craters holding pretty young ice. What are those, and why is it so exciting?
So prior, we don't have any ages for the ice. And so a large part of the motivation for this work is to provide some more constraints on when the ice could have been delivered. Perhaps what you saw in the statement too is we also commented the fact that there are plenty of other craters at the pole where ice exists, and some of these craters are too small to date using these statistical methods that I was talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so some of these craters, because they are small, maybe younger than these old craters. And we're saying if ice does exist within very young craters, that is also very interesting, because it suggests that ice has to have been delivered more recently, or there might be some refreshing mechanism that is active today.
Okay, so that's bringing water ice to the moon right now.
It's an open question, something that we, as well as many of our colleagues, are trying to understand today, which is what is the ongoing flux, or is there an ongoing flux of water delivery to the moon? And is all of the ice that we see at the moon very old, or is there some sort of combination of sources acting to deliver ice, both in the past and also today?
And what would the implications be if you found this young ice?
Well, it's very exciting to think about ice being actively replenished, or at least H2O, because this is a very important resource when thinking about future exploration of the moon. For example, the water can be used, or H2O can be used by the astronauts, and it can also be broken up into oxygen and hydrogen, which can, of course, be utilized for fuel or oxygen as life support for the astronauts. And if you're able to access these resources on another planet, then that offers a whole nother level of autonomy for future explorers, where you're no longer reliant on Earth for supply or resupply of these different resources.
I've been talking to Ariel Deutsch, a PhD candidate at Brown University in Rhode Island and a NASA graduate fellow. Ariel, thanks so much for talking to me.
You're very welcome.
So it's really tricky to get to the moon and to land on the moon successfully. But let's say we got there. Could the moon even support us?
Right. And how many of us? I mean, people love to talk about the idea of colonies on the moon. But, you know, but really, like, what would be the logistics of a bunch of people or, you know, even a city's worth of people living on the lunar surface?
And that brings us to our next mystery. How many humans could the moon support?
Well, why would someone want to live on the moon in the first place? I mean, just, you know, it's got no, you know, there's no air there. There's no, you know, there are no trees there. Why would people want to live there?
So, I mean, I could see various scenarios where leaving Earth might seem like a good move. One of those, if we used up all the resources, which we seem to be doing on our home planet, and, you know, it's the closest celestial body to us, so why not?
Okay, that's you know, the...
I mean, it's easiest for us to imagine sort of as a futuristic home. And, you know, we just talked about how it might not take that long if you have the right fuel and enough of it to get there pretty quickly.
Right. So if we have to, you know, if we have to leave Earth for, you know, one reason or another, that is, you know, that is the closest place. And it's definitely a lot faster to get to than Mars. That's for sure.
But like we said, it's cold and hot there. There's extreme temperatures. There's such a thin atmosphere that there's nothing to hold the heat in. So it can get super, super cold and super, super hot.
Right. So obviously there would have to be, you know, there would have to be a lot of planning that went into building cities, building structures that could get us there. Okay. But if all the logistics were worked out, how many people could, like, you know, could end up moving there at all?
So to figure that out, we could think about the surface, just the area of the moon. And the moon's surface is just about 16% of Earth's overall land area. And that's not counting land covered by oceans.
Right.
So if we took that area, let's say we packed that with the density of humans that are in some of our most populous cities. If we did that, we could probably fit, or, you know, researchers have figured this out, we could probably fit trillions of people.
Oh, wow. Okay. So does that mean that trillions of Earth people are actually, like, could actually set up, you know, like, set up their homes there?
The question probably should be, how many people could the moon sustainably support?
Right.
Not, you know,
not just how
yes,
many people could physically
crammed?
Fit there.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
We
all
might
right.
not be able to move, but.
Okay. But so how do we, okay, so how do we figure out the answer to that?
So we have to figure out what are the things that we need. And we know to live, we need air, water, food, shelter.
Sure.
Those are the things to look at when we're deciding whether we can live on the moon and how many of us could live there.
Okay, so let's start with air.
So there's no real air to breathe. The atmosphere is super, super thin on the moon. So to support a population of a few hundred, let's say, on the moon, we'd probably have to transport air to the moon and then pump it into, you know, some kind of like sealed dome structures for people to live in.
Okay, so you have these sort of bubble homes or these you know, these domes that would cover, you know, large areas, and the homes would be built inside.
Right. And so that could support a small group of people. But if you increase that population, we'd actually need to start making oxygen for us to breathe. And scientists know that oxygen is the most abundant element in the lunar soil, which is called regolith. But we'd have to be able to get that out of the lunar soil and then, you know, create air from it.
Okay, right. So city planning on the moon is going to have to take into account how many people are going to be there and how do we get them enough air so that they can breathe.
Exactly.
Okay, what about next thing on the list? What about water?
So decades ago, we thought the moon was a barren desert, no water, not a drop of water.
Okay.
But you know, now several research groups have found that there is water on the moon. Mm-hmm. You know, some of it is left over from the formation of the moon when the chunk of Earth was knocked off. We also know that comets periodically slam into the moon.
And comets carry, obviously, comets are made of ice. They're these giant snowballs in space. So that's another way that water comes to the moon.
Right. And the water or the water ice could be stored in basically the craters that these comets create when they slam into the moon. So there are smart people who are thinking about this, about how we could get water on the moon. And mm-hmm. one idea is that we could create a closed loop water source.
What does that mean?
Basically where everything that you put in is reused over and over again. So on the International Space Station, they have this technology where they can recycle drinkable water, and they recycle it from the astronauts' shower water, from their urine, from their sweat, even apparently from the moisture from their breath.
Mm. Okay, so no moisture that's used is wasted. It's actually something that can be purified and then recycled into drinking water.
Right. And so it does over time get wasted, of course. And you know, none of these sources are infinite. And, you know, getting the water from the icy craters even or from other places would be costly, scientists have pointed out. So again, like the air, for the first few years, we'd probably have to transport enough water to support groups of humans on the moon.
Right.
And this is sounding pretty difficult.
It's certainly something that, you know, like we wouldn't be able to pull off, you know, in the next couple of years, probably. Okay. So, all right. So that's how scientists might deal with air and water. What about food?
We need to eat.
Yeah.
And so the idea would be to grow food on the moon. And there are projects looking at how to grow food in low gravity environments. We'd have to somehow have some kind of enclosed dome structure to grow these plants. And we'd have to have this recycled water, of course. All this growth is going to take more water.
Right. So that, you know, that raises another issue related to water, because obviously we need water not only to drink and, you know, just to perform, you know, basic hygiene, but obviously any plants that are grown there are going to need water as well.
Right. This is one thing that, you know, NASA and other groups are finding we could do, though. This is feasible. You know, NASA has a project called Veggie, and it's successfully grown, you know, three types of lettuce. It's grown some kind of mustard seed, a kale, even flowers. And these have been grown on the International Space Station.
Okay. So you know, moving back from the original estimate of how many people could you physically fit on the moon, which, you know, could potentially be trillions, to how many people could actually be, you know, like could be sustained living on the moon. So, you know, we're talking about just maybe a few hundred people, right?
Exactly. So what's the issue?
Okay. Well, so, you know, then we got to talk about actually getting those people to the moon, because, you know, all of the moon missions that we've seen so far, they can only bring a few people at a time.
Right. And so to make that transport feasible economically, we'd actually need a pretty big technological leap, you know, something like space elevators, something that could get people up there, not sending them with rocket fuel on this small spacecraft.
I've seen illustrations that show that, you know, what a potential space elevator could look like. And the idea is just mind-boggling, that there could be a physical elevator
that goes to the moon,
that extends from Earth to the moon. Right. That's just
that's one way I think I would go to the moon.
That's actually true. I would, you know, like I would probably be more likely
if
to
I
go
could
to
come
moon.
Back down on an elevator.
Right. I would definitely prefer to go to the moon in an elevator than, you know, like in a shuttle crammed in with dozens of other people. So the idea of a colony on the moon sounds great.
It sounds great. But, you know, with all the logistics, it doesn't seem like something that's going to happen anytime soon.
Right.
Basically, we'll have to settle for our earthbound lives and, you know, looking up at the moon on clear nights.
For now, at least.
We've got a lot of moon mysteries coming up. But first, we're going to talk about something a little more down to earth, and that's reading. I love to read. I read all the time. But there is still not enough time to read all the books. And so sometimes it's really handy to have an app that can just give you the key takeaways from books. And the app that can help you with that is Blinkist.
So Blinkist works on your phone, your tablet, or your web browser, and it gives you all the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and it condenses them down into just 15 minutes. So you can read or listen. It will help you squeeze in a book while you're exercising or on your daily commute.
And one of the things I like about it is that it's a real time saver. I mean, Blinkist saves me time. I can read summaries and I can figure out which book is worth my time to read in its entirety. And so that helps me evaluate where I, you know, like where I want to spend my very, very precious reading time. And because the app is, you know, you can read or you can listen, you could pretty much fit this in anywhere, anytime, just, you know, depending on what you're doing. You can listen to it when you're out for a walk, or if you have a few minutes to sit down and read, you can just, you know, sit down and just read through one of the summaries.
One of my personal favorites here on Blinkist is Becoming by Michelle Obama. It's a book that I've meant to read for forever. You know, I love Michelle Obama, and I've wanted to know the story behind the first African-American woman to become a first lady and live in the White House. The Blinkist summary, while it's not a substitute, of course, for reading the book itself, it gave me a sense of her balance between family, education, career, politics, and how that shaped who Michelle Obama was at the different stages of her life.
With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. All the books you want, and all for one low price.
Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/LLM and try it for free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription.
That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/LLM to start your free 7-day trial.
And you'll also save 25% off, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/LLM.
Maybe one day we'll have colonies on the moon. So, you know, we can still admire it from afar, but we can't admire all of it from Earth because we can't see all of the moon. One side is permanently hidden. It's turned away from Earth all the time. This is sometimes called the dark side of the moon, like in the Pink Floyd song, though technically it isn't dark because it does get sunlight. Recently, China's space agency made a historic landing on this mysterious hidden side. Here to talk to us about that is Mike Wall, senior writer for Space.com, sister site to Live Science. Mike, thanks for being here.
No worries. Happy to help.
First, could you explain how the moon has one side that's perpetually turned away from Earth?
Yeah, it's sort of weird, actually. It's because like the moon is actually gravitationally tidally locked to Earth, which means that it takes the same amount of time for the moon to turn once on its axis as it does for the moon to actually complete one lap around Earth. So since those two things are totally synced up, we only ever see one side of the moon, which we call the near side, and the other side is the far side. It's not the dark side. Both sides of the moon get the same amount of sunlight. It's just we never see the like far side, and we only ever see that near side.
And what does that mean for scientists who study the moon and who work on lunar missions?
Well, it just means it's really hard to study one side of the moon, because one of the biggest problems is if you want to do a mission to the far side of the moon, it's really hard to actually get any communications to or from that sort of rover lander, whatever it might be, because, I mean, you can't communicate directly with it because you've got the whole giant chunk of rock called the moon blocking you and blocking those communications. So to actually explore that, the far side of the moon, you first need to actually launch like a communications relay spacecraft to a point that can see both like mission control and also the surface craft on the far side of the moon. And it's that extra step is not trivial. And it just means since like the near side is so much easier to explore, direct route, direct communications, most missions, in fact, almost all missions have gone to the near side. It's just easier.
Can you give us an example of how scientists have overcome that challenge and how much is known about the moon's hidden side?
Yeah, there is only one mission to date that has explored the very mysterious far side of the moon. And it's still active today, actually. China's Chang'e 4 mission put down both like a lander rover combo last January 2019. And both of those craft are still active. And to sort of stay in communication with those craft, they actually did what we were just talking about. First, they actually launched like a communications craft to a special spot, like kind of beyond the like far side of the moon, where it can keep in constant contact with both mission control and with the lander and also the like rover on the far side. And so that duo has been exploring one spot on the moon's far side for about 14 months now. And yeah, it's like pretty exciting. We've gotten our first up close look at the far side of the moon from those two craft.
That is really amazing. So what are some of the things that they've discovered so far?
Well, it's kind of, we've gotten in sort of dribs and drabs just because, I mean, China is not, has not historically been as sort of open with their data releases as say NASA is. You know, NASA like tends to have a policy of, I mean, here are all the rover pictures that we've taken. They're on this website. You can go to like JPL's website, for instance, to see all of like the Curiosity rover images that it's taken on Mars. Those are just open source. China is a little different. They tend to kind of parcel it out much more parcimoniously. So we've gotten a few data dumps from them, though. One was this past January, and one was another paper that just came out just about a week ago. And so we've gotten a lot of imagery from those two kind of data dumps. And the second one was like gravitational data that like Chang'e 4 rover U2-2, which means Jade Rabbit 2. It carries as part of its science package. It's got ground penetrating radar. So like as it rolls along, it sort of takes a reading of the near subsurface under its wheels. And that's the data that we just got about a week ago. And it's pretty interesting. It shows us down to about 40 meters underneath the sort of lunar surface. It like paints a picture of a very fractured top layer of the moon that has experienced lots of impacts, which you would expect. You know, there is no atmosphere on the moon to stop asteroids from coming in, so it gets bombarded all the time by stuff. But it's just given us a like sort of insight into what that structure is, which is something that we didn't have for the far side.
And what are some of the next steps for exploring the moon's secret side from China and from other space agencies?
It's unclear what's going to happen in the near future. There aren't any big like kind of missions on tap to go further explore the far side in the next few years. But people are excited about what the sort of scientific potential of the far side. And like one of the things is that like a lot of radio astronomers would actually love to get like a big radio telescope built on the far side of the moon, because it's extremely radio quiet over there. Because as we were saying before, you know, it's blocked by the entire bulk of the moon's body from Earth. And Earth is always just, it's constantly broadcasting out this radio noise, you know, from our cell phone towers, TV broadcasts, all that stuff is streaming into space constantly. So it's swamping like a lot of these small, subtle little signals that are coming from deep space. And I'm not necessarily talking about alien civilization signals or something, but just like the natural processes in space that like generate radio signals that like radio astronomers love to study. So if you can put a big radio dish on the far side of the moon, you would like you get rid of all that noise from Earth because it would be blocked by the moon's body. And so it would be a great place to kind of have like a laboratory set up and get really good data from deep space. And there are people talking about doing it, you know, using craters on the far side as like a natural depression to kind of shape a big radio dish into. That'd be really expensive and really difficult, and people want to do it. There are no real concrete plans to actually do it, but it's sort of been a scientific dream for a lot of people for a long time now.
And speaking of alien civilization signals, you are also the author of the book, Out There, A Scientific Guide to Alien Life, Antimatter, and Human Space Travel for the Cosmically Curious. So let's talk about the search for alien life. Is that part of any upcoming missions to the moon?
I would think most people, I mean, outside of like 2001, like a Space Odyssey sort of stuff, no. But I mean, like I was talking about with those radio dishes, you know, I mean, if you're looking for some kind of like techno signature from an alien civilization, maybe it's really faint. Maybe it's coming from really far away. It would be a good thing to kind of have, to have a radio dish on the far side of the moon to actually look for some of those signals. I mean, it's just one of those things, you know, science, you just never know what you're going to get. So in these like exploratory sciences, radio astronomy, this sort of thing where you're dealing with phenomena that we may not completely understand, it's like always best to build the most capable instruments where you can get the most data, and you just never know what you're going to find. And so, I mean, say we do build a giant radio telescope on the far side of the moon, we'll probably discover a lot of cool things about like black holes, pulsars, neutron stars, that sort of thing. And I mean, who knows, maybe you'll get lucky and you'll get a little ping from somewhere that you can't understand and doesn't match like any kind of known astrophysical phenomenon. And I mean, maybe you'll be off and running with something really interesting. You just never know.
I've been talking to Mike Wall, senior writer for Space.com, sister site to Live Science. Check out his article, Chinese Moon Rover Peers Beneath Surface of Mysterious Lunar Far Side, on Live Science. The link is in the show notes. Mike, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
I'm going to step off the limb now. It's one small step for man, One giant leap for mankind.
That famous audio is astronaut Neil Armstrong, of course, taking his first steps on the moon in the Apollo 11 mission in 1969. Many astronauts' footprints remain on the moon because there's no weather to erase them. But that's not all that astronauts have left behind on the moon. And a lot of what they've left behind just isn't as photogenic as a footprint. There's garbage, a lot of garbage, and abandoned gear from past missions, and wreckage from crashed spacecraft, and astronaut pee and poop, and even alien microbes. Of course, these are alien to the moon since they came from Earth. So in today's final mystery, we ask, how much trash is on the moon?
So since humans first started sending spacecraft to the moon in the 1960s, how much garbage have we left behind?
Oh, a lot. So much garbage. It's more than 100 objects, and they collectively weigh about 400,000 pounds, which is over 180,000 kilograms. So
how can we put that into perspective?
Well, think of the Statue of Liberty times two. That's how much garbage there is on the moon right now.
And the moon's much smaller than Earth. That's a lot of garbage.
Well, yeah,
for just a few trips.
Right. Well, but you know, some of those pieces of garbage are very big, very heavy things that were left behind. There are robotic probes and crashed orbiters that were used to map the moon before the Apollo crewed missions were sent there. So altogether, there are 70 wrecked spacecraft, and that includes crashed orbiters, but actually other spacecraft that was not necessarily wrecked but had to be left behind, like rovers that were used by the astronauts and then modules that were used to bring them to the surface.
So some of this is intentional. These right. are left on the moon on purpose.
Right. So, in fact, NASA had 9 Ranger spacecraft that were sent to the moon between 1961 and 1965 that were literally built to crash. They were designed to dive bomb the moon and as they did it, to just take thousands and thousands of pictures. So, and that was just going to help scientists to map the surface of the moon.
NASA also sent the Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite, or LCROSS, went to the moon to find the first evidence of water there. And that was launched in 2009, so crashing was part of that plan as well.
Right, and that was literally how it did its science. So the first part of the mission was to slam a projectile into the moon to kick up this massive debris cloud, and then the second part was to fly a spacecraft through the debris cloud and sample it to see what it was made of. And so the piece that was hurled at the moon was the satellite's spent rocket. So this was, you know, like the rocket that got out to space in the first place, didn't need it anymore, so, you know, launched it to the moon. And then the satellite flew through it, sent the data to NASA scientists on Earth in real time, and they actually found evidence of hydrogen at the lunar poles from crystals of water ice. So that confirmed that there was water on the moon.
So that crash really was fruitful for science.
It was iceful.
Yes, iceful. Okay, so I get those things that are on the moon, but what about other trash?
Okay, well, there are smaller discarded bits of spacecraft, you know, that you know, had broken off, or bits of wreckage. There are also astronauts' tools, so things that astronauts used while they were visiting the moon that were then left behind. So, you know, things like rakes and shovels and backpacks and, you know, packets of space food. And then there's also personal hygiene related garbage. So there are, you ready for this, 96 bags of pee, poop, and puke that have been left on the moon, as well as used wet wipes. And,
thank God for the wet wipes.
And wet wipes, right. And wet wipes, you know, are very, you know, very valuable things to have in space. And but, you know, then you got no place to put them, so you got to leave them somewhere, and the moon's right there. And, you know, even in like empty food packets. So, yeah, I mean, but the thing is, like, this is all, you know, this is excess stuff that the astronauts don't need anymore. And so, you know, carrying that back with them would take right. a valuable space, so it's actually easier and, in fact, you know, safer for them to just not have all, you know, all that unused extra stuff on the flight home with them.
And one of the bits of trash that I found intriguing are the golf balls. There's apparently two golf balls on the surface of the moon. What's up with that?
Okay, that is true. Yes. So this was the golf balls were brought there as part of the Apollo 14 mission. So this is in 1971, and astronaut Alan Shepard was conducting some experiments where he actually brought a golf club.
Quote, experiments. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, right. So, no, well, you know, pretty much everything that the astronauts were doing on the moon was an aspect of data collection.
Data,
right.
Yeah.
So even doing really mundane things on the moon is something that would still give scientists valuable information about, you know, about the lunar surface and about gravity and just about how things work in space.
But who wouldn't want to try to hit a golf ball on the moon to see what the heck happens?
If you're going to bring, you know, if you're going to bring a golf club to the moon, you got to bring some golf balls. So, and he claimed that he had the perfect golf swing and the balls traveled for miles and miles. But there is footage of what he was doing there. Because, of course, the astronauts had to document all of their experiments. They couldn't just do these things and then say, hey, NASA, I did this thing. No, they had to actually show evidence of what they were
doing.
So
wait, what did it look like?
Well, according to the footage, he actually did not connect as much as he said he
did. It was not so perfect.
So, yes. So he actually missed some of those shots that he said went for miles and miles.
Okay, so what are some other, more of the weirder trash left on the moon?
Okay, well, there are a bunch of flags, American flags, of course. 12 pairs of boots, a bunch of cameras, because, once you've taken the photos, you don't necessarily need to bring the camera back with you. And they're actually movie cameras there, too. Some astronauts have also brought and left behind on the moon these personal mementos, photographs of their families or, objects that had some kind of a personal meaning for them. I mean, very few people get to visit the moon. So, if you're going to visit the moon and you have the opportunity to leave a little bit of yourself behind, yes, it seems like, it's an opportunity that, you can't really fault them for that. And they've also left behind objects that commemorate their colleagues as well, other missions and even astronauts, both American and Soviet astronauts who died in the course of the space race.
Right. And there are pictures documenting that. It's sort of surreal to see a feathered lion on the moon.
Yep. Yep.
And recently, an even weirder object or thing was left on the moon.
Oh, yes. It was a lot of things. It was a bunch of tardigrades. So tardigrades are these microscopic creatures that are also known as water bears. And they're oddly adorable. And one of our favorite things at Live Science. They're, of course, you can't see them with the naked eye, but they're everywhere. You can pretty much find them everywhere where there is water and moss. And they have these segmented bodies and these little tiny claws. And
they're indestructible almost. That's
pretty much
one of the pretty cool things about tardigrades. So.
Right. So one of the superpowers that tardigrades have is that they can go into a state of suspended animation where they expel all the water from their bodies and they enter something like a dehydrated state called a tun state. So when the Israeli lander Bereshit was sent to the moon, it was carrying a payload of thousands of these dehydrated tardigrades. And so they're in this tun state. And then when the lander crashed,
This was not.
The lander was not supposed to crash. But when it did, then, the tardigrades, obviously they may have been destroyed in the crash, but they may not have been. They may just have been, their little dehydrated bodies may just have been spread over the surface of the moon.
And we know they can survive for a very long time in this tun state.
Right.
But there's no water on the moon, right?
Right. There's no water. So tardigrades, when they're dried out like this, they cannot reanimate unless there's water. So, because people were speculating, oh my God, does this mean that, there's going to be like
a tardigrade colony
growing up on the moon, right? But unless they come into contact with water, that these tardigrades are not coming back to life. And even if they did, they would have to have landed someplace where they were protected from UV radiation because, that could also destroy them. So right now the status of the tardigrades is unknown. If any of them survived the crash, if they're still on the moon. But perhaps if there's another mission to the moon in the future, that, might be something that could be investigated.
Right. Rescue mission.
Mm-hmm.
I have to ask. So we have all this stuff on the moon, including poop and pee. Why haven't we cleaned up?
Well, in some cases, the crashes, like as we said, were part of actually performing science.
So, right.
So scientists knew that they were going to be, creating wreckage on the moon that was not going to be removed, that, there was no way they could remove it. But at the same time, the data that they were going to be gathering was important information. So that seemed like that was a reasonable trade-off. And in other cases, the tools that were left behind, the pee and the poo, you would want to just remove all your trash from the moon, but all that stuff creates extra weight. So by necessity, anything that is not absolutely essential when the astronauts were leaving the moon, the most important thing is for them to get back home safely. So anything that was not absolutely essential to them being able to do that was just left behind. And also what it does something else. This, yes, it's trash, but it also creates kind of an archaeological record of humanity's exploration of the moon. And yes, you know, it's still a record preserved in trash, but it's still, you know, part of the history of our relationship with the moon.
Thanks for joining us today for Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. All of today's lunar mysteries, why is it so hard to land on the moon, how many humans could the moon support, and how much trash is on the moon, are available as Life's Little Mysteries articles on our website, livescience.com. You can also find out more about these mysteries in this podcast's notes.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter for even more Life's Little Mysteries and for the latest science news. You can also join the conversation in our Live Science forums, where you can pose Life's Little Mysteries questions of your own or even suggest topics for upcoming podcast episodes. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss out on new episodes.
What will we talk about next? It's a mystery.
Literally, it'll be another Life's Little Mystery.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audioboom as part of their Audioboom Originals Network.